Let's join together for a moment of silence in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. My name's Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here again. We're going to go tonight to the forward to the second edition and keep on going through the book. In this forward to second edition, I was going to start reading here. It says, since the original forward to this book was written in 1939, a wholesale miracle has taken place. Somewhere around 3,000 years ago, alcohol was discovered. And somewhere around 1934, AA seems to have gotten started. And so that's where I get 2,934 years from the time of alcohol first being discovered or invented and the time that it was found that alcoholics could recover. And that's when the book was written in 39. Or AA got started in 34, and in 39 the book was written. And so they're saying here, since the original foreword was written in 1939, a wholesale miracle has taken place. In other words, I think it's on page 27, not sure, but somewhere near is where Carl Jung said to Roland H., here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had these vital spiritual experiences. And now they're saying, you know, a wholesale miracle has taken place. And to put that into perspective with something we mentioned earlier, page 19, it says, they wrote the book for the purpose of how can we convey to others? You know, how can we get across to others that there is a way to recover? And so it seems that, and I'm not touting the book by any means, I do not worship this book, but once the book was published and once the information got out, more people are finding out that, yep, you can recover. The second sentence here in the foreword to second edition says, our earliest printing voiced the hope, quote, that every alcoholic who journeys will find the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination, end quote. That is not true. And let's turn to page 162, and we'll see what our book really said. In the past couple of years especially, this is something that's really come to mean a lot to me and to some other people, because I believe this is one of the most important things that we need to keep in mind in trying to help other alcoholics. On page 162, that last full paragraph there, about two-thirds of the way down the page, here's what our earliest printing said. Our earliest printing voiced the hope that someday we hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. It didn't say we hope they find the fellowship. And some people will certainly say, you're being way too picky over a simple little word, a or the or whatever. I hope that as time goes on, and maybe even tonight some, as we go in through more with the second edition, it'll become apparent, you know, why that's important. So let me reread that sentence on 162, and let me just turn two words around and take the capital letters off of them. Someday we hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find a fellowship of anonymous alcoholics at his destination. A room full of people who know who they are, where they've come from, where they're going away. A room full of people who have recovered from the hopelessness of alcoholism and know how to help other people recover and are looking for the opportunity to show them how they recovered so that these new people can recover also. And so the people who wrote our book were saying, we hope that someday there will be enough recovered alcoholics around, and there'll be enough autonomous AA groups around, a new idea we haven't talked about yet here. But we hope there's going to be enough groups around that every alcoholic who journeys will find a fellowship of recovered alcoholics, a fellowship of anonymous alcoholics at their destination. And that concept of at their destination is something that I think is really interesting. Somewhere in Bill's story, he says, we meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. You think about that for a moment, that's quite an assumption. It's like I could say the people who first helped me were consciously thinking, we meet frequently so that someday that guy's going to find what he's looking for. And what he's looking for and what he's going to find is the recovery that can take place, you know, within an AA group. Not because the group heals people, for heaven's sake. Alcoholics Anonymous, no AA group. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't fix people. No AA group can fix people. But it's when recovered alcoholics get together and they carry a message that something happens. Let's just real quickly look at 152. I'm going to expand on that thought. Then we're going to go back to the forward to second edition and try sentence three. On 152, we have a hypothetical question and answer session going on here that, you know, Bill, as he's writing our book. On 152, that first full paragraph, it says, "We have shown how we got out from under." Now, we've shown how we got out from under alcoholism, how we recovered from alcoholism. We've shown you how we did that by doing these things that we now call the steps. And so you proposing this thought to the new person, to the newcomer, to the AA prospect, it says you, Mr. Prospect, Miss Prospect, you may say, "Yes, I'm willing to do whatever it takes. But am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know that I must get along without liquor, but how can I?" And keep in mind that in this book, we assume that the reader already has a desire to stop. So here's a person who has a desire to stop, and here's a person who says, "I know that I must get along without liquor. I must stop. I have to, not because somebody told me so. I want to, and I know I'm going to have to stop, or it's going to kill me. But how can I?" There's the question. "I know that I must stop. I want to stop, but how can I?" And listen to this. "Have you, or do you have, a sufficient substitute? Have you got something to take the place of alcohol in my life? I can't live with it. I can't live without it. Have you got a substitute for alcohol?" Yes, there is a substitute. And it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the substitute for alcohol. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to come here and drink up the group or eat up the group. But the fellowship that takes place within the autonomous AA group, as we individually learn to grow spiritually, to help each other grow along spiritual lines, and to encourage each other to continue living by the spiritual principles, you know, so clearly outlined in this book. It says, yes, there is a substitute, and it's vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the fellowship of, but a fellowship in. There, as a member of that AA group, you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. And somebody, I can hear somebody arguing, say, "Well, if I'm a member of a group, I'm a member of AA." I'm not trying to split hairs over AA membership. Being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous never did anything for me. Being a member of an autonomous AA group made up of people who had recovered and who could show me how to do that, now that did something. It took the place of alcohol, showed me a way out of that mess. It says, there you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. And I might add, release from the care, boredom, and worry that used to drive us back to drinking. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. And someone's going to say, "Well, oh, right there it is. Thus we find the fellowship of AA." And that's not what that means. In this last sentence of this paragraph, that word fellowship is a verb. And what Bill is presenting to us here is that it's the spiritual fellowship that we share with one another within our autonomous AA fellowships that ends up seemingly being a substitute for alcohol. That is the idea that was voiced in the earliest printing of our book. Let's go back to forward to second edition. And the next sentence says, already twos and threes and fives of us have sprung up in other communities. And so voicing the hope that we hope that someday every alcoholic who journeys will find a fellowship of anonymous alcoholics, find an AA group, some people who have recovered who can help him or her do that too. We hope that happens. And by the way, already we've got twos and threes and fives of us that have sprung up in various communities. And so it's kind of like looks like that might happen someday. You know, at the time they wrote the book, they're thinking that. Reading on, it says 16 years have elapsed between our first printing and of this book and the presentation in 1955 of our second edition. And in that brief space, AA has mushroomed, and they give some numbers about the growth of AA. Down at the bottom of Roman numeral 15, it says, the spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker, who was Bill W., had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day. And if I may, I'd like to go to the forward to our 12 and 12. And in the forward to our book, 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, on page 16, there's just one little paragraph there that is made up of really only one sentence. And it says, the basic principles of AA, as they are known today, were borrowed mainly from the fields of religion and medicine. And so back here in the foreword to the second edition, on the top of Roman numeral 16, it says, it talked about Bill having been relieved of his alcoholic condition, relieved of his drink obsession, much more specific and definitive there. But Bill had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day. Now, the Oxford groups is a name that was attached to some small groups of people that were gathered together to try to carry a message that they thought was important to the world. And it was two of those people from one of those Oxford groups that went to help Ebby. And so in our 12 and 12, the foreword says the basic principles were borrowed from the fields of religion. I can make a very simple statement that our 12-step program of action, the recovery program that we got, was borrowed from the field of religion. Some people might not like this, but I can tell you that when AA first started, they're sitting down together in the morning over breakfast, and they had the Bible open and saying, how can we go put this into practice today? And how can we learn how to live this so we don't have to drink anymore? And going back to the forward to the 12 steps and 12 traditions on page 16, the next sentence at the bottom of the page says, after 3 years of trial and error in selecting the most workable tenets, the most workable ideas or basis upon which the society could be based, and after a large amount of failure and so on, they talk about three successful groups emerging. Well, there's 3 years of trial and error in selecting the most workable tenets upon which the society could be based, and really upon which our recovery program could be clearly defined. Those were 3 years of trial and error with Bill and Dr. Bob and some other people sitting down and taking a look at what our religious friends have to say about the way we ought to be living. I don't mean in the sense of rules and regulations, but the way that God intended for us to live, and being of service to others and being of service to Him. And so all that came to us from outside of AA. On the top of Roman numeral 16 again, in the foreword to second edition, talking about Bill W., it said he had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William B. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members. Silkworth is the guy who explained to Bill the hopelessness of alcoholism. And Bill knew that he was already feeling hopeless. Bill had repeatedly tried to stop drinking and ended up drinking again, and Bill knew he couldn't control it once he started, knew he couldn't stay sober once he stopped. So here's Bill Wilson, who has heard about the hopelessness of alcoholism from a medical doctor. And that doctor was able to put into words something Bill already had experienced. Bill Wilson had heard about a practical program of action, you know, from his friend Ebby, who got it from these religious guys. And we also know that Bill Wilson, through Roland H., who had been to see Dr. Carl Jung, was given the specific idea that an alcoholic must find that spiritual awakening. And so it seems that Bill Wilson had three things together, three things that came together at one time, and Bill Wilson just happened to be the guy that was there to hear him. He knew what the problem was. He knew the hopelessness of alcoholism. He knew what the solution was. There had to be a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience in order to recover. And he knew what the program of action was that it took to bring about the change. And some other time we may get into a little more detail, and that Linda can tell some of this better than I can even, but it's like Ebby didn't quite have all three of those things. And in just a minute here, we're going to see that Dr. Bob didn't have all three of those things. And it was when Bill Wilson gave him the rest of the story, so to speak, that something different began to take place. From this doctor, I'm reading here in about the middle of that first paragraph on Roman numeral 16, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. And though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. And I'm sure everybody here can hear the steps, you know, in that last little sentence here. Prior to his journey to Akron, before Bill went to Akron, he had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic, but he had succeeded only in keeping sober himself, and it does not say keeping himself sober. A lot of people get that idea twisted around. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture, reading again, which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. And he suddenly realized that in order to save himself, so to speak, in order to stay sober, in order to stay recovered, in order to keep from drinking again, I don't really care what the words are, but in order for him to be able to continue attempting to live and be any kind of happy and successful about his sobriety, it says here, he suddenly realized he must carry his message to another alcoholic. And the part that they don't tell us in great detail here is the part where during those 6 months in his trying to help other alcoholics, Bill was quite depressed about the fact that nobody was getting any help. And so Dr. Silkworth told Bill, listen, Bill, stop preaching to him. Stop talking about God and stop talking about that great spiritual experience of yours. At least stop talking about it for a little while. Just go drive home the hopelessness of alcoholism. When you drive home the hopelessness of alcoholism, maybe they'll be more willing to accept this spiritual way of life. Now, I did not intentionally say that to set it up for what we're going to read next, but that's exactly the situation we're going to see here. The bottom of Roman numeral 16, forward to second edition. This physician, Dr. Bob, had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. And we know that it's an historical fact that Dr. Bob was involved with the Oxford groups at or near or around the same time that Ebby Thatcher got sober. I don't know for sure that Ebby and Dr. Bob had ever met, but Dr. Bob had repeatedly been trying to use this religious approach to staying sober, but it failed. He wasn't staying sober. And listen to this next little sentence, but, complete change of thought. We're going to put something in here that you never thought of before. It says, but when the broker, Bill W., gave him, Dr. Bob, Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and his hopelessness, the physician, Dr. Bob, began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. And he did not do that by changing groups. He stayed right there in the Oxford groups. He kept right on trying to do the things that they were showing him that he ought to do in order to become a person who could live life on a spiritual basis and be okay no matter what comes down the pike. But the difference was this time, after he heard the hopelessness of alcoholism, he began to pursue that very same course of action that had seemed to repeatedly fail for him in the past with a new willingness that he had never before been able to muster. And that's why, even though some people find it disturbing, when new people come, you bet we want to encourage them. You bet we want to tell them, oh, there's hope. Yes, there's hope. You can recover. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. We want people to know that we care about them. We love them. But it's like we have to drive home the hopelessness of alcoholism. There are several recovered alcoholics right here in this room. And every one of us here who have recovered know, we know that we have to face that very thing. To face that hopelessness and to admit hopelessness and powerlessness. A few weeks ago in a meeting, I told a guy, a certain guy that was in the meeting, and he had a plan about how he was going to stay sober. And I didn't want him to misunderstand, so I tried to very carefully explain to him, listen, if you think you have a plan by which you stay sober, our book says that we should encourage you to follow your own conscience. Anything that you think will work, you go ahead and give it a try. But understand this, we're not going to support you as you do it. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a support group. We are not here to support the newcomer's efforts to try to stay sober by whatever means he might think will work. No, we're here to encourage and to help each other recover from alcoholism by taking these steps that are in this book. And that includes presenting the hopelessness of alcoholism first. And so as much as some people might not like it, some people find it disturbing, and at great risk of being accused of running people off from time to time, you know, we have to tell them the truth. I was talking to a friend of mine just a couple of days ago, and he knows nothing about AA, doesn't need to know, and you know, he doesn't understand this idea that we can talk to somebody with love and compassion in our eyes and tell them, it's either do this or die. You know, we're not just not here to split hairs and play games about that. Reading on here at the bottom of Roman numeral 16, again it says, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy, the very same spiritual remedy, for his malady with the willingness he had never before been able to muster. It says here he sobered, never to drink again, up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another alcoholic, as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. And I think it's important to note those two things here, at least briefly. The idea that it takes an alcoholic to help an alcoholic, it's not the same thing as saying that nobody except an alcoholic can ever help an alcoholic. I think God, however we might understand God individually, is bigger than that. If God would choose to work through a teetotaler to help an alcoholic, or work through an alcoholic to help a teetotaler, you know, who are we to call God on how he might do that? But the one thing we know is that an alcoholic can help another alcoholic in a way that other people probably can't, and in most cases certainly can't, simply because he or she has been there. And it's not that we go to someone and say, oh, listen, I want you to know I've been right where you're at and I felt all the things you felt, therefore you should identify with me. That's not what it's about. It's to go and to talk about that hopeless feeling that we had. In order for me to be able to express the hopelessness I felt when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to hear it from other people. I didn't know it was okay to admit that you felt hopeless and desperate. I didn't know it was okay to admit that sooner or later the person I am is going to drink again. And I don't understand why, and is anybody like me, and so on. And so it's in our own admission of the defeat that we suffered, of the hopelessness that we lived in the past, that other people have the opportunity to do the same thing. And point number two, on the top of Roman numeral 17, it says it also indicated, this thing between Bill and Bob also seems to show us that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. Some people seem to believe that unless we make a whole bunch of effort at jumping through a whole bunch of hoops, as often as we can, as high as we can, trying to help other people, unless we do that, God's not going to keep us sober. Now, I do not believe, personally, that God operates under a comparative value system, and that's what that sounds like to me. But the one thing I have found, unless I become willing to practice constant thought of others, I am by default going to practice constant thought of me. And when I practice constant thought of me, I end up feeling real bad about me and how bad I got it. and that pour me, pour me, pour me a drink. So the two ideas, an alcoholic can help another simply because he or she can show through their experience that they've been there. And in trying to help others, it gives us an opportunity to be free of the selfishness and the self-centeredness that was killing us. We're going to have some discussion. We'll come back in a couple of minutes and do that. Now, thank you. A little bit ago, we were looking at the forward to the second edition, or excuse me, the forward to 12 steps and 12 traditions. It says on the top of page 17, the Infant Society determined to set down its experience in a book which finally reached the public in April of 1939. At this time, the recoveries numbered about 100. The book was called Alcoholics Anonymous, and from it, the overall fellowship of AA took its name. In it, alcoholism was described from the alcoholic's point of view. Also, in our basic text, the Spiritual Ideas Program of Action were codified for the first time in the 12 steps when our book was written. The idea is that there was a program of action that two men from the Oxford groups passed on to Ebby, and Ebby to Bill, and Bill to Dr. Bob, and so on. And when our book was written, the program of action was codified into the 12 steps. Point being, in some meeting rooms, we'll see the 12 steps on the wall. People who attempt to take the steps off the wall seldom do very well, because you cannot reach that list, the codification, and take the steps. Taking the steps is something that's done by following the directions or learning from the experience shared in our basic text. And the rest of this sentence makes that point clear, because it says, when our book was written, the application of these steps, the application of these steps to the alcoholic's dilemma was made clear when our book was written. And the idea of the steps being applied to the alcoholic's dilemma. The alcoholic's dilemma, we all know what it is, hopefully. Apart from divine help, we're dead. And how to apply a practical program of action to that dilemma is made clear in the book that we call our basic text. The book, Alcoholics Anonymous, became, if you look on the dust cover, the basic text for our fellowship. This present volume, the 12 and 12, proposes to broaden and deepen the understanding of the 12 steps as first written in the early work. A lot of people look at the 12 and 12 as a step workbook. The 12 and 12 is not a step workbook. Nobody here can show me any directions for taking the steps out of the book called 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. 12 Steps and 12 Traditions proposes to broaden and deepen the understanding of our basic text. And anyone here can understand that you can't broaden and deepen something you haven't got. Until we have an understanding of what's in our book, this 12 and 12 could be rather misleading and confusing. Not because there's something wrong with it. You just can't broaden and deepen something you haven't got.
I'm Chris, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Since you've mentioned the 12 steps, I would like to mention one thing that's on page 15, second paragraph. This book deals with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm talking about the 12 and 12. It presents an explicit view of the principles by which AA members recover and by which their society functions. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happy and usefully whole. Mm-hmm. And those of us that have recovered have experienced that.
Right.
And then prior to that, miserable.
I hadn't thought about that in a while, but that's one of my favorite little things here. The 12 steps are a set of principles, spiritual in nature, which, when practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession, enable us to live a life which is happily and usefully whole. It's kind of neat the way they're put together. We learn to practice the 12 steps. The obsession to drink is removed. And we have recovered, and that's how it happened.
The expel, that's a pretty big word there.
Yeah. Anybody ever been expelled before?
My name's Brian. I'm an alcoholic. What Chris was just talking about, the 12 steps, you know, can't even be possibly done on an individual basis. You know, that's why it is very helpful that he become a member of an autonomous group where he can't, I mean, he could still fail at those things, but it's those people that he's fellowshipping with that help him to understand what he's doing, you know, while he's doing it, and then help him to see that those things are possibly his own thinking in nature. And I mean, because we're all there, you know, that's why it is very important to become a member of a group, you know, to be helpful with other people and for those people to be able to help you so that you can live according to those principles, because we just can't do it on our own. There's just no way. That's the importance of the group.
Sure. And that's not to say that some individual couldn't practice spiritual principles as through the 12 steps and so on without a group to be part of. Certainly it can be done. And we're not in any way trying to create dependence, a wrong kind of dependence here. We're not trying to make people dependent upon the group. It's just that if someone's in a position where they have to practice it on their own, you betcha. But when we have the opportunity to gather together in our little autonomous fellowships, and we'll be the opportunity to help each other, you know, learn and grow and work together and to hold each other accountable to a certain point. You know, I love what one guy that most of us have heard on a tape, you know, he talks about rowing around in our little invisible AA boat, you know, and he said, and somebody's over there, and he said, he's getting a little bit out of line, or he's forgotten some of the simple things, the basic things that are important here, and he says, hey, your aura's upside down, goof, you know what I mean? It's like, not being critical, not judging anybody, you see somebody kind of wandering off their side, say, hey man, hey, you know, get back over here, get back in the middle. And so it's like we have the opportunity to practice this way of life with other people who are trying to do the same thing. We don't have to do it alone. That's the neat thing.
I'm Cindy. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Cindy.
And what you were just talking about is really the only loving thing to do, because due to the hopelessness of this illness, we can see what kind of danger someone's in. I see people who attend AA meetings who perhaps are trying to take the steps off the wall, so to speak, as you mentioned earlier, and sometimes I just get the feeling like I'm looking at someone just adrift, like a leaf being blown around in the wind. You know, they're looking for something. Nobody's clearly driven home the hopelessness to them, so therefore they're still looking for what they want instead of realizing how hopeless they are and becoming willing to work with a group that'll tell them the truth. And along that same note of hopelessness, I did have a thought about that. I, for a long time, was uncomfortable talking about the hopelessness I used to feel. Well, I never really tried it a lot until it was pointed out to me by my sponsor how absolutely necessary it was when working with somebody new. And I remember when I first really sat down and did that with someone, it was rather uncomfortable. But now that I've gotten used to doing that, I'm no longer uncomfortable. And I recently had an experience of a meeting full of people who were, for the most part, still in treatment. And that was the topic that we used. We picked a couple pages out of the book that deal with the different kinds of drinkers and the hopelessness of the real alcoholic. And a couple of us, who happened to be the first couple to speak, just started out talking about our hopeless drinking experiences and the hopelessness we came to feel before we became willing to actually do this. And boy, these guys, I've sat in meetings with some of these people who were there before and they're in treatment and they just always passed. We almost couldn't shut them up. They just talked and talked and talked. One of them said it really made an impression on him. A couple of us have heard from somebody who was at some people in treatment settings who were at that meeting. I started out talking about the hopelessness just to follow directions. But boy, it really seemed to make the difference the other night. It really hit home with these guys.
Good. I think most of us here have experienced it, whether we were aware of it at the time or not, whether we're aware of it yet. It's only in looking back that we can really put things in perspective. One of my favorite lines in the book, the thing on page 198, you know, I well remember over a long period of years when I thought I was the only person in the world who knew that sooner or later I was going to get drunk. And for myself, scared to death to admit that. You know, the guy that ended up sending me to AA asked me, did I want to stop drinking? And I wouldn't answer him at first. I wanted to stop drinking, oh yeah. But I was afraid to tell him I wanted to stop drinking because I couldn't. And I didn't want to tell him I wanted to stop drinking because I didn't want to have to get in a position of trying to explain to him that I couldn't stop drinking when I didn't know why I couldn't stop drinking and thought he might judge me harshly if I told him. And yeah. But you talk about that hopelessness. When other people who are feeling hopeless hear us talking about hopelessness, it's kind of like, oh, really? It's okay to say that? It's okay to admit the truth about myself and accept the facts?
I'm convinced I'm alcoholic. There's a few times in meetings that I think that maybe if I put myself into the other people's shoes that don't want to be there, the people that are drinking, and all I do is talk about how wonderful it is now, and we were talking about this earlier, how Bill and Bob, or how Bill was preaching that religion stuff. I still, they try to put my everyday life into what I'm talking about when I'm in their meetings, because I can't make them people, and make it all rosy, you know what I'm saying? That hopelessness is still very evident today if I'm not doing exactly, and I can't do it exactly, but if I'm not doing what I'm talking about, I'm doing, because I sat around AA meetings for a long time and told you people that everything was wonderful. And I don't know if I said that it was wonderful, but I, looking back, I see where there was still people suffering in my life. There still is today. You know, not as bad, or maybe not to the extent, but I'm an alcoholic, and I don't practice these principles perfectly, and ever will, and I try, and it talks about that now, it works, that, well, however it says it, I can't read the quote or whatever, but we strive for,
our goal is perfection. We strive for perfection, but we only claim progress. And it's like when we set the goals short. It's a tough thing. None of us can be perfect. Any one of us here could probably take a real good, clear look and realize that we still do cause some confusion and some harm in the lives of others because we're not perfect people. The fact that we're alcoholics is no longer an excuse. Thank God we're aware of that. The fact that we're merely human, I don't know if that's really an excuse that we dare use very often either. You know, yeah, we're human. No, we're not perfect. And no, we can't do it perfectly. But it's that constant effort, you know, that conscious effort to make the difference. Just as it was pain that drove us here, and just as it was pain that motivated us to get started in this thing in the first place, is it not the pain that we feel or that we see in others because of our actions that drive us to keep going and keep doing more? You understand? There are some things that personally I used to do and quote unquote got away with them, you know, for some time. But eventually realizing the pain that's causing, as small as it might be, you know, as minute as it might seem to be, nah, that stuff adds up. And there's a lot of things that, you know, down the road, we just can't make excuses like we used to make. It's a matter of getting with it and going. In any given situation, we've always got the opportunity to say, you know, am I going to humble myself before God and truly attempt to be of service and to be considerate and kind and compassionate toward other people, or am I not? And that's the bottom line. That's that step six thing about consciously, actively seeking humility as a way of life. My religious buddy, I kind of threw that idea at him the other day, and he immediately talked about being proud of our humility. And I let him know that I'm very aware of that tendency, that we can be proud of our humility at times. But I don't think there's any sick, goofy pride in saying that we want to consciously pursue, consciously seek humility as a way. That does not have to become a prideful, egotistical thing, although it can be it. And that's the deal. Knowing that a few sharp words to this person or that person, knowing that those sharp words are simply not going to be helpful, and knowing that those sharp words could, in fact, and probably will, just cause more pain and more alienation. Seeking humility as a way of life says, I'm going to stop talking until I know exactly what to say and why to say it. Not because I've got a right to say it. Nope, that's no reason to talk. Not because I want to. That ain't very good either. But because we've humbled ourselves enough to ask somebody, what should I do? What should I say? What would you do if God was standing beside you watching? Now, I don't like that. That smacks of performance. That smacks of jumping through hoops. But what would God say if I was standing there watching him? Our job is to try to do as he would have us do. And you'll find that idea in our 12 and 12 in a couple different places. Believe it or not, in AA literature, you'll actually find the word Lord with a capital L. You'll find the word Master with a capital M. I'm not sure about the word Lord. I just caught myself there. But Master for sure. And the one question you'll find in the 12 and 12, what would the Master do in this given situation? You know, what would God have us do?
I'm John, I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And what you were just talking about, our goal is perfection, and you know, knowing that I'll never achieve total perfection, I'll never become God. The fact is though, that each day as I go along trying to realize the things that although I am human, I'm going to make mistakes. Even though I'm recovered, I'm going to make mistakes. But those mistakes do not have to lead back to that bottle, to the same old actions. Because if I am continuing to take steps 10, 11, and looking at the day and seeing how many times I have stepped on the toes of fellow man or and hurt somebody else, I continue to grow. But if I get to the point where I don't get a choice to determine how far along that progression level I go. The minute I started doing that, I stopped. And that's a common thing I hear all the time. You know, and it's very easy for myself as an alcoholic to where I try to grab hold of that and say, well, you know, I'm not where I want to be. It don't matter where I want to be. I just do it. And through doing it, we grow. But with the idea of having taken the step and become a member of an autonomous group and having joined in the fellowship of that autonomous group where each person's, you know, watching out for each other, helping each other to be able to go put the message out there that we have recovered. Make sure each person's on the right track, and so forth. All my life, drinking and stuff, I went about life the way I wanted to. I tried to be director. I tried to control other people. I tried to make other people love me. I tried, you know. And the thing is, I don't have to do that now. It doesn't matter now. I just go about life trying to help somebody else, thus getting out of myself. And this other stuff that comes along with it, it's just a fringe benefit of something that's happened from that. if I start going about life like I used to, and I still do sometimes today, you know, I'm not perfect, you know, but that's no excuse. You know, I still need to try to work on it as much as I can. If I continue to go about setting those goals and determining how I'm going to achieve that goal, you know, how I'm going to take control of that, my reliance upon God has diminished, and I've gone right back into self again.
The thing to do is to avoid that confusion. We only have one goal, spiritual perfection.
Right.
Glenn, you had a thought earlier about immunity against drinking. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I'm Glenn, a recovered alcoholic. Talking about humility and seeking that as a way of life, I was sitting here thinking about how in meetings, kept trying to carry this message to other alcoholics. I don't do that so I can be okay. I do that because they need love.
That's right.
We have. On page 132, it says things like, when we see a man sinking into the mire that is alcoholism, we give him first aid and place what we have at his disposal. And on down the page, the very last full paragraph, the last sentence says, we have recovered and been given the power to help others. But thinking about that, how many times have we been attacked personally for carrying the message? And it wouldn't take very long if I wasn't seeking humility as a way of life, if I didn't have to do that, that I wouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't do that anymore. I got tired of those things before, and I stayed away from and actually tried to hide from confrontations and things like that. And
I mean, you don't look forward to getting beaten up every Friday night or whatever night?
No.
No. But the joy of carrying the message on page 130 says that we have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. And that's the kind of hope that I never had, that living a life of sane and happy usefulness. And so to have that, I'm not willing to give that up. And part of that, you know, thinking about what Dr. Bob talked about when he said, I spend much time carrying this message. The reasons why he did that, you know, the sense of duty and taking in insurance against the next drink. And he did it because somebody did it for him, you know. And I'm grateful for that stuff, that people helped me to just have that. And it's like, wow, you know. When we do that, when a person actually gives themselves to that, the more they do it, the more they want to do it, and the more they do it, the more they want to do it. And that's the thing that I like to see. Is people.
One of the stories in the back of the book, I believe it's a lady's story, where she says, true freedom is doing the things we ought to do because we want to do them.
Yeah, I heard Ed say that.
Anybody else got a final thought here?
Just a thought on humility, since we're talking about it. That real famous guy did say, do your things in private. Don't do them out where everybody can watch you, so they'll make you look good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't try and impress people by telling them they're hopeless and they're helpless and that I was bad before and I'm so good now.
My first sponsor never talked about humility much. He told us, as far as humility goes in AA, he said, they'll talk about it a great deal. He said, you may not live long enough to see any of it, but they'll talk about it a great deal. Yeah.
You know, that's in the same sense that going to other meetings and putting the information out there, although we know essentially that some people will turn deaf ears and they may see us as being pompous or whatever. You know, the fact is, putting the information out there, putting it straight out, not in a sense of like, look, here I am. You know, I mean, that's not humility. You're putting it out there, knowing that you're putting it out there to help that person that's in there suffering, wondering, what the heck am I going to do as soon as this meeting's over? With myself, you know, there was lots of times I was afraid to even open up and ask anyone and let them know. I mean, they could see I was suffering. But to ask for that help, because one thing, I didn't think there was help. So how am I going to ask for it? And to be able to put that information out there and a no bars hold type way.